Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. The Disability Advocacy Group has raised a list of housing needs that are not being met by Hamilton or the Ontario government for all applicants, not just the disabled. Hamilton has a subsidy program that's underfunded at capacity with a long wait list and is not known by most clients. Disability Advocacy Group is calling for all disabled to have a subsidy that goes with them, is not affixed to property, but is assigned to us. Spokesperson Michael Hampson says we'll work out the details together. Today, we have a guest to discuss subsidies that go with the clients and the problems with the current priority waiting list for even the priorities that the province has chosen. Disrespect welcomes Sherrad Carrer, Executive Director of the Ontario Nonprofit Housing Association. He's here today to discuss the priority system of housing for both victims of domestic abuse and the other needy people on anywhere from 3 to 17-year waiting lists for public housing in Ontario. Welcome to the show, Sherrad.
Thanks very much, Jeff.
Well, we were just talking about the problem with the waiting list. You got involved in formulating policy, did you, for the original waiting list and the priority system for victims of domestic abuse?
Well, we're an association, first of all, of 760 nonprofit housing providers throughout Ontario,
right.
Helping those on a variety of different scales in terms of their needs for housing, everything from seniors to families of low income to those living with mental illness and requiring supports to homeless people. So,
does that nonprofit, does that include co-ops?
The co-ops have a similar mandate, but they are a different governance mechanism, and therefore they have their own association dealing with their governance
right.
situation.
Okay. So this is basically every nonprofit except co-ops.
Every nonprofit but co-ops, that's correct.
Okay.
So currently what we have, and I'm going to start with the premise, the fact that we have a dramatic need in Ontario for purpose-built, affordable rental housing, of which there's been a dramatic shortage over the last 10 to 15 years, ever since housing was actually canceled by the former Conservative government. And while the current Liberal government has done its best to be able to build as much new housing, we still do not have as much housing as we need. In fact, a recent study that we've done called Where's Home? 2010, which studies housing in 22 different communities, shows that we're about 10,000 units short per year for the next 10 years in terms of just providing adequate supply for those who just need affordable rental housing in Ontario.
Let me put that in perspective, because I'm still trying to realize what this horrendous shortage means. Does that mean if we needed to house everyone on the waiting list today, it would take 10 years times 10,000 units?
It would be actually impossible to house everybody on the waiting list just simply because of the magnitude of the size of the problem.
Right.
In 2010 alone, we have 142,000 people sitting on the social housing waiting list. That's up 10% over 2009.
All right.
And the wait time actually ranges, Jeff, anywhere from 5 years to as long as 21 years.
Right.
So if I can put that in context, a child that is born today mm-hmm. will be of university age by the time that child is actually able to be put in affordable housing, assuming that housing exists.
Yeah, and assuming that there was an application made out when they were born.
That's correct.
Yeah. I spent 17 years on the Toronto housing wait list, and I finally just resigned. I read about all the problems. It became apparent from the tone of voice of the people I was dealing with that they thought I'd been worked over. Having been there for 17 years as by now an out-of-towner. And I just began to think, look, it's a system that's not working in any sense. The housing isn't working. The wait list isn't working. Why am I on this list, you know?
Well, actually, that's quite a very accurate comment that we hear from the social housing registries about people who just simply walk in, try to find out how many people are on the social housing waiting list, and just simply give up and then move along. So the 142,000 on the waiting list that I mentioned are actually people who have made application that we know of. We believe that the number is actually quite higher, especially out in the smaller urban and rural communities where there's a tendency to actually just bunk in with friends and family or couch surf as we know it.
Yeah. So your study again was called Where's Home?
It's Where's Home 2010.
Okay.
And what we do is every year we analyze 22 different communities to be able to determine the affordability gap in housing as well as what the affordable rental housing shortage is in Ontario.
Right. Well, you have a different version, I gather, of what might be the beginning of a more workable system. In other words, you've told me directly that you don't think that people in urgent need of emergency housing, such as victims of domestic violence, should go on a waiting list. And if they weren't on the housing waiting list, this would free up a tremendous number of units. But
well,
how would
it,
you take
it
them
would,
off
but
the
I
list?
Don't want to give any of your listeners the impression that we do not believe that victims of domestic violence ought not to get a priority. We very much believe that victims of domestic violence need to be given priority status in terms of addressing their needs. These are people that are fleeing an abusive and violent situation.
Right.
In a lot of cases, they are women who are single moms mm-hmm. with children trying to get out of a situation and right-size the situation for both themselves and their children. The problem is that the current administration of the policy makes an erroneous assumption that if you simply give victims of domestic violence priority status on a waiting list, that will actually solve their problem,
yeah.
when in fact it won't. Because,
no.
number one, we have a system that is already woefully short in terms of the actual supply.
Right.
So it cannot service those who are even on the chronological list, let alone those who are given special priority.
Right.
The second problem that we have is that there's an erroneous assumption that victims of domestic violence are best served by a housing policy only. When in fact what these individuals need is they need strong support mechanisms in order to be able to get themselves out of an abusive situation and get themselves into a life where they can actually live an independent life.
Yeah, if they're leaving behind an abusive partner, they've left behind all their supports, practically.
Exactly. So the solution that we actually see from the housing standpoint is we believe that they should be given an emergency housing allowance that actually gives them an ability to be able to find the housing that they need, not just in social housing, but even in the private market, so that they can actually get out of the abusive situation that they're in
right.
and get into housing that will help them stabilize their lives almost immediately.
Has anybody now it's a little like provisions for people with disabilities. People keep complaining that they cost too much, but in fact, given our view of dignity and equality or equity, let me put it that way, dignity and equity in our society, these are steps that have to be taken for those people, and they have to be taken for victims of domestic violence too. But has anyone quantified what this is likely to cost?
Well, obviously there is a cost attached to any kind of system that you're going to create.
Right.
I mean, as an example, what is the cost of not housing these individuals to society in terms of not being able to get them out of the situation that they're currently in.
Yeah.
There's a huge cost.
And we're paying
associated
that
with that. And we are paying for that. So, and it's the same, kinds of situations where we talk about not utilizing housing to its full capacity in terms of being able to deal with issues around education and healthcare. I think the situation in terms of victims of domestic violence needs to actually be elevated to a much higher level within the province of Ontario and
so
the Ontario government.
So this first priority on the waiting list is just, I don't know, I almost want to say a red herring. It's just not enough.
Well, putting them putting them on a priority list is not going to help them. In fact, we believe that it's actually going to hinder them in the long run, because I think in terms of just simply saying you're now got priority status in the waiting list, that priority status in and of itself will have a chronological list to itself,
mm-hmm.
and therefore people will just simply continue to wait.
Right.
The real problem that we see is the fact that, number one, there's not enough housing supply available, so we need more affordable rental supply for everybody,
right.
including victims of domestic violence.
Right.
And specifically for victims of domestic violence, we need something that will get them out of their situation and put them into a stabilized environment immediately, because it is an emergency situation.
Yeah.
And therefore, we think that giving them a housing allowance that enables them to actually do that almost immediately, whether the housing is available in the private market or in the social housing market, makes no difference. The thing is to get them into the housing. In fact, there is a proposal that's currently out there by an organization called Interval House that actually has submitted to the province of Ontario a pilot program amounting to about $500,000 over a two-year period, where they want to, in fact, provide housing allowances to about 50 families that are victims of domestic violence, to get them housed, to be able to, in fact, track whether, in fact, this is a good idea or not. And we, quite wholeheartedly support Interval House in terms of their approach, and we are strongly encouraging the government to actually fund that pilot project right now.
How would they pick those 50 families? Did they give that away in their proposal?
Well, no, they haven't. They haven't talked about that, in that detail. But I think the concept of what we're talking about here is what I've alluded to in terms of trying to, in fact, get victims of domestic violence stabilized in terms of housing, regardless of where that housing is, by giving them an emergency housing allowance.
Yeah. Well, the pilot will be interesting. I don't know how long it will go on. Hopefully, not very long.
It would be a two-year pilot, according to the proposal, which I think is long enough to be able to gather some empirical evidence as to whether this
comparative evidence, then.
Empirical, correct.
Yes, but also comparative between
exactly.
the people who had to wait and the people who didn't.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's interesting. So I would imagine that there'd be a big fanfare about that, and it probably is being held back for an election announcement.
Well, we are hoping that the province is going to do something once it releases its long-term affordable housing strategy.
Mm-hmm.
That strategy was supposed to come out in the spring, but as you know, the province decided that they wanted to get it right and therefore have delayed it until the fall.
Mm-hmm.
So we're quite anxious to be able to see whether, in fact, from a strategic standpoint, the province's long-term affordable housing strategy will deal with the special priority policy in a forthright kind of way.
So this redo of housing strategy will also involve priority for victims of violence and hopefully
priority for
homeless people and things like that, too.
That we're hoping that that's going to be the case.
Of course, dealing with victims of domestic violence in a prompt way will also assist. I don't want to indicate that this is enough, but it will also in itself assist the homeless people, because immediately they won't be waiting behind the victims of domestic violence anymore.
That's true. I think once you are able to provide victims of domestic violence a workable solution that helps them, the sort of the artificial solution of trying to just simply get them on a chronological waiting list, ahead of other people, will sort of loosen up the system a little bit. That's not to say that you wouldn't want to continue to have a priority status. Municipalities have several priority statuses, including victims of domestic violence.
Right.
For medical reasons or for extraordinary situations.
Oh, they do have priority for medical reasons.
They do. Some municipalities will have certain local priorities, what's referred to as local priorities.
Okay.
Which still enables people for, in sort of emergency need situations to be able to get housed beyond people on the chronological waiting list.
Right.
Those are situations that have to be addressed, and rightfully, those individuals do need some special consideration, as do victims of domestic violence. But to be able to just solely say there's only going to be one administration system dealing with one specific group is simply not the right way to go about it.
Mm. So you kind of like the current policy of giving municipalities power to set priorities below the imperatives that the provinces set.
Well, not necessarily. I think the province should maintain its provincial interest in terms of saying what is good for housing from a provincial standpoint.
Right.
And ensuring that local municipalities do, in fact, adhere to those provincial priorities.
Right.
But the manner in which it's implemented should be left up to the municipality. So it shouldn't bottle the municipality in terms of saying you should do it this way or that way. It should establish the fact that there is a provincial priority and let municipalities have the option of how best to actually implement that for their own local community.
Okay. So if you were someone who were a victim of domestic violence at this time, or if you cared for someone who was a victim of domestic violence at this time, what steps would you take to secure inexpensive and immediate housing?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, Jeff, because there aren't a lot of options available for them.
Shelters, isn't it?
I mean, there are only shelters available. The shelters are getting full. They are not the most, appropriate for situations, especially where children are involved.
Right.
People are fearful of the shelter system, as much as municipalities do try to, ensure the safety of the residents. And it is a short-term solution. Shelters are a short-term solution. They are not a long-term stabilizing home environment for anybody.
Yeah, my understanding is that most shelters won't take people for longer than 90 days, and a lot of them won't take them for longer than 30.
Well, they won't, and that's the nature of a shelter. I mean, shelters were built for transitional housing purposes only, as a temporary measure to be able to ensure that people have at least a place to stay for a short period of time. And that's what the intention is of a shelter. It's not there for any kind of long-term stay.
What does the family do when their time runs out of the shelter?
For victims of domestic violence, again, is a mismatch between what the needs of the individual are versus the type of housing that's available to them.
Yeah. What happens when your time at the shelter runs out? What do? You go to another shelter or what?
You try other shelters. And this, again, is symptomatic of anybody that's facing a lack of housing. You try to find places with family and friends. If you can't find family and friends, you are literally living in cars or living on the street.
And this, obviously, to have gone on for so long, I don't want to point fingers or name names, but this clearly has to have been acceptable to some component of the existing housing administration, or it wouldn't have gone on for so long. Raising your voice, but people in the business, they're not, they haven't raised their voice loud enough.
Actually, that's not true, because the violence against women agencies, as well as the social housing providers, have always maintained that this is a problem. And right from the get-go, when the policy was introduced, they could see on the horizon that there were going to be problems. Now what we're doing is we're starting to see the manifestations of a policy over a period of 10 or 15 years in terms of taking hold. So now the empirical evidence is actually catching up with what was predicted 10 or 15 years ago.
So it's gone from a prediction to a horrific reality.
It is, exactly.
Okay. And you're hoping that the solution will emerge 2 years down the road from a pilot project that's still hanging fire before the McGuinty government.
Well, we're actually hoping that the solution will take shape a lot faster than that.
Right.
Because with the provincial government now developing an affordable housing strategy and about to release that, hopefully by the end of the year, early next year, they were supposed to release it in the spring, but again, they've said that they wanted to get it right, and therefore they're going to release it later this year or early next year. We're very... we're watching very anxiously whether, in fact, the special priority policy will be addressed in a forthright way to be able to deal with the current issue. We think that the government should rightfully maintain a special priority policy, but again, to solely use the chronological waiting list as one of the key elements of solving the problem does no good to those who are waiting for the housing or for the actual providers who are required to provide the housing to people.
Yeah, I was helping to look after my mother when she died, and I went to the housing as it happened in Halton, and said to them, my partner and I are looking for housing. We've just lost the housing we've got because of a death in the family. What can we do? And they said, well, you can go into shelters. And I said, well, as homeless people, do we not have a priority? And they said, oh, yeah, you have a priority, but you'll wait, you know, easily 2 years. And I said, well, what will we do? No shelter will put us up for 2 years. She just kind of shrugged and turned her face away, and she said, oh, you'll have to sort of switch shelters for 2 years. And I thought, what an attitude, you know. It's like, you know, it doesn't even say I'm sorry, you know, but our region can't keep our people out of the rain. Years ago.
Well, in defense of, to the frontline staff who do the best that they can, they can only offer solutions. They can only offer as many solutions as they have available to them. If they aren't given a bevy of solutions to offer, then, unfortunately, in your situation, you happen to be, part of just simply a frontline worker giving you the best solution that they knew best. It's sort of
moving
tantamount
to
going to a grocery store and yelling at the cashier for not having good service when, in fact, it's management's role and responsibility to ensure that there's good customer service.
Well, we didn't yell at her. We just walked away, and then we told the former mayor of Burlington what we thought of his housing system in a business-like way.
Sure.
And he made the same point. He said, well, look, if you'd gone on that list 2 years ago, you know, you probably would have had housing by now. And I was just disgusted. It's like he's recommending sleeping around for 2 years too.
Yeah.
But it is an unworkable system, and it does need a new approach, and it's going to take some money. Where do you think it's going to come from?
Well, I think the government right now is saying that because of the bad economy, we have a deficit, and there needs to be some deficit management. So I am not hopeful that we will see the money coming out of the government anytime soon. Certainly not out of the provincial government. I had hoped that maybe we could see some money coming out of the federal government. But again, the federal government has been quite absent in terms of its role and responsibilities in terms of housing throughout the entire country.
Yeah.
I think that, regardless of the economic situation, it's bad business practice, bad government practice to simply say, we can't do this because we can't afford to do it. That is not a tolerable situation.
Or we can't do it now because right now things are good and we don't need to do it. You know,
that's correct.
The
I mean,
the
situation
point.
Has always, been a situation where certain levels of government have claimed in good economic times we don't need to provide it because the economic times are good, and in bad economic times we can't do it because we can't afford to do it.
Yeah,
so the question is, if you can't do it in good economic times and you can't do it in bad economic times, when, in fact, are you actually going to do it?
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll hear that on the hustings in the coming year as the Liberal government goes up for re-election. Is there anything else that you would like to say about this conflict and this issue that's been smoldering for so long?
Well, again, I think, the bottom line to this is the fact that as an association, we strongly support wanting to have a workable solution for victims of domestic violence. We don't think that the current administration of a waiting list system as being the sole means by which victims of domestic violence get their housing is the workable solution. We think that it must have a broader solution that involves an emergency housing allowance from the housing side. But additionally, we think that victims of domestic violence need to have proper funded supports by the provincial government, and therefore we would strongly encourage the current government to actually raise the profile on this issue beyond just housing and actually involve the Ministry of Community and Social Service and the Attorney General's office at a minimum.
Maybe the Health Ministry too, eh?
So that this, yes, this has to become a cabinet-level priority for the government.
I appreciate that. Well, thank you very much, Sharad, for coming on the show and proposing this.
Great. Thank you very much for having me, Jeff.
Yeah, and thanks for taking time out from your evening, too.
No problem.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Sharad Kerur, Executive Director of Ontario Nonprofit Housing Association, talk about solutions to the priority for housing for abused women and a reasonable wait time for the rest of the applicants on the waiting list up to 20 years. And now for a break before the news, Lightning Hopkins, the Moving On Out Boogie. Welcome to Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These aren't the full stories we read for you, but excerpts or condensations of the stories from the papers that we name in the broadcast. We're interested in your vote for whether you want more news, less news, or you like the amount of news that the show provides. And we'll remind you of our email address, which we also give at the end of the show. It's dialogue, the British spelling, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, dialogue at radio.fm. Now this week, something a little special, our annual International Bacon Day broadcast. Coming up this Saturday, International Bacon Day, and our news accordingly. This week, first, Andrew Picard in the Globe and Mail, a huge snub to Medicare. Does Canada still have a federal health minister? And more important, does it have a government with the slightest interest in maintaining the national health insurance program called Medicare? For all practical purposes, the answer to both of those questions is a resounding no. Leona Aglukkaq, who holds the title of Minister of Health, was glaringly absent from the Canadian Medical Association gathering in Niagara Falls, Ontario, the first time in living memory that the steward of Medicare failed to address the annual meeting of the so-called Parliament of Medicine. The Prime Minister's office decision to keep the minister away from the CMA General Council is powerfully symbolic.
It should send a shiver down the spine of everyone who cares about the future of health care. The ministerial no-show is a monumental snub. It is a snub to the CMA and a snub to Medicare. Mr. Harper's government has taken the view that health is exclusively a provincial matter. Constitutionally, health is a provincial domain. But to suggest it is exclusively a provincial domain is the political equivalent of a literal reading of the Bible. Regardless of what constitutional fundamentalists contend, Ottawa still has a tremendous responsibility in the delivery of health care and its oversight. When Medicare was born, Ottawa picked up 50% of the bacon. And over time, it has gradually weaseled out of its financial duties. The Canada Health Act sets out five guiding principles for Medicare: public administration, comprehensiveness, universality, portability, and accessibility. When he was vice president of the National Citizens Coalition, Mr. Harper said, "It's past time the feds scrapped the Canada Health Act." Ms. Glukak was busy posing for photos with the Prime Minister in the Arctic, so she did not attend the CMA meeting. Having a health minister who is silent and invisible is part of a strategy of ignoring Medicare and pretending the Health Act does not exist. Today, with the challenges posed by an aging population, fiscal pressures, technological advances, and ever-increasing expectations, we desperately need leadership. We need a government that believes in Medicare and is willing to reform the public health insurance system to make it sustainable. We need vision and passion. What we have instead is a shocking abdication of a responsibility and destructive silence. Again, from the Globe and Mail. Private health care battle erupts. Josh Wingrove in Edmonton. Wild Rose Alliance calls for more private care, while New Democrats urge less. The long-ruling progressive conservatives in a battle over health care privatization are being challenged for the first time on the political right to expand privately run, publicly funded care. The Wild Rose Alliance, viewed as a threat to the PC voter base, held a news conference at Calgary's Health Resource Centre, Canada's only privately owned hip and knee replacement centre that has overnight patients. The publicly funded, for-profit centre might be closed this fall as the province tries to bring the operations back into publicly owned facilities. The sides are currently locked in legal bacon. Wild Rose leader Danielle Smith slammed the government on Thursday, calling the privately owned, publicly funded system more efficient than the public system. Meanwhile, the New Democrats slammed last year's funding cuts to long-term care in the province. With Wild Rose calling for more private care and the New Democrats urging less, the government is staying tight-lipped. Globe and Mail, Andre Picard. Medicare has feet of clay, says new CMA head. Canada's Medicare system is built on a foundation of lofty principles, but in practice, it is failing to deliver the timely, equitable, and cost-efficient care to which patients are entitled, Canada's top doctor says. To my fellow Canadians, I say on behalf of all doctors, you deserve better value. You deserve better service. You deserve better. And we will fight to ensure you get it, Jeffrey Turnbull said Wednesday in his inaugural address to the Canadian Medical Association. The new president of the CMA said with $183 billion spent on health care last year, resources are not lacking, and with thousands of dedicated health care professionals, there is no lack of will to deliver quality health care. The problem, Dr. Turnbull said, is the glaring lack of execution of policies and principles that results in the problems patients experience every day. Long waits, shortages of beds, waste, and lack of coordinated care. What we need most, even more than increased funding, is better and more effective systems of management and governance. Canadians value their health care. They cherish the idea that services are provided without regard to income or means, the idea that quality health care is the birthright of all who live here, Dr. Turnbull said. But you can't be cured by an idea. You can't be made healthy by a theory. The system needs to work in practice. in British Columbia. Forest fire smoke sparks Alberta health alert. Alberta's chief medical officer is warning people with respiratory problems to remain indoors as a pall of acrid smoke from British Columbia forest fires hangs over the province. Prevailing winds are blowing the smoke into much of Alberta, and other weather conditions are keeping it close to the ground, turning blue skies a dusky gray. I strongly advise people with asthma, bronchitis, or emphysema to remain indoors, keep their windows closed, and take any preventative measures their physicians have previously recommended, Andre Corriveau said. Healthy people should also avoid strenuous physical activity outdoors while the local air quality is bad. Anyone who experiences difficulty breathing should contact their physician. Firefighters are battling nearly 300 wildfires in BC, almost all of them in the interior and the north. The most serious fires are in the Cariboo region, where more than 2,000 people have been evacuated. Alberta health officials say smoke and fine particulate matter in the air can be absorbed deep into the lungs, where it can aggravate existing health conditions. Friday, August 27th, Toronto Star. By Anne-Marie Tobin in the Canadian Press. Seniors' caregivers suffering, study finds. 1 in 6 people who take care of the everyday needs of ailing seniors at home is in a state of distress, says a study of more than 130,000 people aged 65 and over who receive publicly funded long-term home care in Canada. These informal caregivers are flagged as being in distress when they're unable to continue providing care or they're expressing feelings of distress, anger, or depression. The report released by the Canadian Institute for Health Information shows that those caring for seniors with moderate to severe cognitive impairment, such as Alzheimer's or dementia, are most at risk. The definition of informal caregiver in the study doesn't include professional home care workers, but rather the spouses, adult children, friends or neighbors of seniors who assist with chores and other activities of daily life. Says Nancy White, manager of home and continuing care development at Canadian Institute for Health Information. In fact, the caregiver themselves may end up in hospital or needing treatment because of the stress they've been through. The report shows rates of distress are higher among those providing more than 21 hours a week of care, those caring for seniors with depression and cognition problems, and those displaying aggressive behaviors. Toronto Star, August 26th. Mental Health Crusade Unites Foes. By Jim Coyle. Helena Jasek was telling a charming story the other day, the kind you don't often hear at Queen's Park. It was about teamwork, collegiality, cooperation across party lines. And it was, said the Liberal MPP from Oak Ridge's Markham, the most rewarding thing she's been involved in since her election in 2007. Jasek was excited that the legislature's Select Committee on Mental Health and Addictions will deliver its report on Thursday. That's today. She'd been invited to join the committee by PC MPP Christine Elliott, on whose initiative it was struck, and but for Elliott's personal overture, might not have participated, she said. Then Jasek told of how, as the committee wrapped up 18 months' work, searching for a title for its report, she and NDP MP Gelinas hit on the right words and high-fived in delight. A Tory, a Liberal, a New Democrat. How could they possibly work together in such partisan times, especially with an election in sight? How could they produce the kind of productive, collaborative effort citizens wish was the rule in politics rather than the exception? It helped that the issue of mental health was so compelling and the stories the committee heard about an inadequate system so raw and honest. As Gelinas recalls, it was a rare day she didn't leave hearings in tears. In all the towns we went to, we heard of a system that fails people with catastrophic consequences on their lives, the lives of their families. It was awful. You cannot have that many people come to you and then turn around and spew out political rhetoric. It would be completely disrespectful. It helped, too, that Elliot has personal experience with a son with special needs, that Jessica is a doctor with a keen understanding of the system, and that Gelinas is a healthcare professional with an MBA. It helps, as Jessic says, that the committee's travels took them out of Queen's Park and that on the road they had a chance to feel each other out. gain trust. Under the chairmanship of the likable Liberal MPP Kevin Flynn, Oakville, the committee worked in every sense of the word. Said Gelinas, "Sure, our political lines are different, but it really became clear the issue was too important for that. The people who came to us truly are hoping for change, and they finally had a chance to voice what was wrong with the system and basically cry out for help. Everything else got pushed aside. For instance, the controversial LHINs, Local Health Integration Networks, came up. The committee knew it was a divisive matter, likely to become an election issue, so people worked around it," Gelinas said. The number and stature of women MPPs on the committee also made a huge difference, Gelinas said. In its report, the committee will release the fruits of a rare and special exercise, one where people spoke and politicians listened, one where the humanity MPPs have in common counted more than the labels that divide them. Virus linked to chronic fatigue. Study. A U.S. government study has uncovered a family of mouse viruses in some people with chronic fatigue syndrome, raising questions about whether an infection may play a role in the complicated illness. The study does not prove that having any of these viruses causes harm, stressed co-author Dr. Harvey Alter of the National Institutes of Health. But it strengthens suspicions, and the U.S. government has additional research underway to determine if the link is real. The virus connection first made headlines last fall when Nevada researchers reported finding a specific type, named XMRV, in the blood of two-thirds of the 101 chronic fatigue patients they tested. But several other studies, including one from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, failed to find XMRV virus in patients, making researchers wonder if this was a false alarm. The study, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, thickens the plot. This time, scientists examined the blood of 37 chronic fatigue patients and again didn't find XMRV. But instead, they found a group of closely related bugs named MLV-related viruses in 86% of the cases. Marijuana effective in reducing pain, Montreal researchers show. A team of Montreal researchers has lent scientific credibility to the view that smoking marijuana can ease chronic neuropathic pain and help patients sleep better. People suffering from neuropathic pain often turn to opioids, antidepressants, and local anesthetics, but those treatments have limitations, and the side effects can be punishing. Many physicians and policymakers, however, are reluctant to advocate the use of cannabis, since there has been little scientific research into its effectiveness, even though patients champion its use. The study, published in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, found that pain intensity among patients decreased with higher potency marijuana. It is one of a handful of scientific attempts to determine the medicinal benefits of the drug. We're not saying that this is the final solution for chronic pain management. As with any pain strategy, especially with chronic pain, we know that the best approach is a multidisciplinary one, said lead author Mark Ware, director of clinical research at the Allen Edwards Pain Management Unit of the McGill University Health Center. All that this does is open the door to the cannabinoid being another tool in the toolbox in treating chronic pain. Lawyers urge jail alternatives in the Toronto Star, August 15th. Tracy Tyler, legal affairs reporter. Niagara Falls, Ontario, people who suffered from fetal alcohol syndrome and commit criminal offenses don't belong in jail, Canada's largest lawyers organization says. At its annual meeting, the Canadian Bar Association's Governing Council urged the federal, provincial, and territorial governments to fund resources for alternatives to incarceration. Said Rod Snow, incoming president of the association, "Our sensing is premised on certain assumptions that people learn from their mistakes, that deterrence works. But when it comes to individuals affected with fetal alcohol syndrome, increasingly known as fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, the term the association uses, the science is telling us these assumptions are not necessarily the case because the symptoms include poor impulse control." Another serious issue confronting the judiciary is unrepresented litigants, particularly in family and civil cases. Speaking with reporters at a news conference, Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin said the problem is that the system is not designed for self-represented litigants. By the time their cases are heard in the Supreme Court, most litigants have obtained lawyers, said McLaughlin, although the court recently heard an appeal from a self-represented woman in a family law case via video link from British Columbia. McLaughlin said her court has tried to make it easier for self-represented litigants. At the Supreme Court, it means ensuring staff lawyers are available to answer questions, notifying litigants if any documents are missing, and ensuring their opponents have been served with their material. And from the Star, Terry Pekoski, staff reporter, Bed Bug Summit slated for next month. Those itching for a solution to the city's bed bug problems could soon get answers at a conference slated for Queen's Park this fall. The summit is a follow-up to the Renters' Right to Know Act, a private members' bill tabled by MPP Mike Colley in June, which would require landlords to let prospective tenants know if there are or may have been bed bug problems in their buildings in the past 5 years. The conference will be modeled on an April bed bug summit in New York City, recently named the most bed bug infested city in the U.S. by an extermination company, Terminix. Colley said he wants to generate a list of 10 solutions that could be implemented immediately by governments and pest control companies. What's the best methodology? That's what I'm going to be asking the experts, he said. I want their recommendations on their best practices. I want people to work cooperatively on it. It's everybody's problem. Again from the Star, Monday, August 23rd. Editorial. Don't slash funds for the neediest. In March, the province announced that it intended to replace a food supplement program for eligible welfare recipients because it was not sustainable and not achieving the intended results. Now, Ontario's most needy are waiting to see what the new program will look like when it's introduced as early as next month. But the government has yet to reach out with any formal consultations among advocacy groups, let alone with the poor, who will be directly affected. That has fed fears that Queen's Park is not interested in producing a better program, just a cheaper one. Such a move would hurt some of Ontario's most vulnerable, those who suffer the twin scourges of poverty and illness, without even succeeding in saving any bacon. Ontario's special diet allowance currently provides $10 to $250 a month to some 165,000 welfare and disability support recipients, enabling them to buy specialized foods to better manage medical conditions such as multiple sclerosis and diabetes. Restricting their access to those extra funds by tightening the rules will only make them poorer and consequently sicker. All it does is transfer the costs, plus additional ones, from the welfare budget to the healthcare budget. One heart attack from diabetes, for example, costs the healthcare system $18,000, according to the Canadian Diabetes Association. One kidney failure requiring dialysis, $63,000. Surely the government recognizes it is better to improve someone's ability to manage their illness through proper diet than it is to sit back and wait for them to arrive in a hospital emergency room. It's understandable that a government already running a substantial deficit would have concerns about a program whose costs have risen from $6 million to $221 million since 2003. But the underlying problem is not the design of the program by itself, nor the alleged fraud suggested by the provincial auditor last fall in a report the government seized on. It is need. At $585 a month for a single person, the current welfare rate is clearly inadequate to keep a roof overhead and buy food, let alone nutritious food. For it to do any good to anyone, including taxpayers, the new program must meet the needs of those it purports to serve: welfare and disability support recipients with medical conditions. It is difficult to see how that can be achieved without the two ministers involved, health and social services, talking to them. And from the Globe and Mail, by Adriana Barton in Vancouver. Locavore High. Farm to school. Goodbye hot dogs. Hello salad bar. Schools across BC will be providing fresh local fare to students while teaching them about agriculture and food security. Do healthier meals mean more focused kids? Given the choice between a salad bar or lunch packed by mom, a surprising number of students at Mountview Elementary go for lettuce and mustard greens. At the tiny school in Williams Lake, BC, 160 out of 200 students line up on Tuesdays and Thursdays to munch on asparagus, broccoli, or snap peas, and tuck into dishes such as bison vegetable chili. The school opened the salad bar 2 years ago as part of British Columbia's Farm to School Network, which aims to include children in the locavore movement. This fall, 24 schools in the province will offer an array of vegetables, fruit, and heartier fare using ingredients supplied by independent butchers and nearby farms. Public health educator Joanne Bays founded the program in 2007 to support local food producers and meet the nutritional needs of kids. Kids are getting the best foods and farmers are finding a market, she says. The veggie-infused dishes have done wonders, says Rick Miller, principal of the kindergarten to grade 7 school. Teachers have noticed higher energy levels and better concentration among students in the afternoon classes, especially on salad bar days, he says. They're happier kids. They're more stable. And we don't have things like arguments and fights, he says. We just think it's because they're well fed. Child hunger and obesity are flip sides of the same coin, says Ms. Bays, project manager of BC's Farm to School program. As more farmers retire or get squeezed out by industrial agriculture, she says, we are losing the capacity to feed ourselves that local fresh food. Farm to School offers grants to upgrade school kitchens, which are often the size of broom closets and serve little other than hot dogs, she says. Grants are shared with local farmers to invest in greenhouse growing, transportation, and storage equipment. Run by the Public Health Association of BC, Farm to School is funded by school districts, health authorities, municipalities, and private sponsors. The program strives to support local food producers and educate children about where healthy meals come from, Ms. Bays said. Students visit farms and greenhouses to learn about how fruit and vegetables are grown. In some cases, they help prepare local produce in farm-to-cafeteria programs that have flourished in schools such as David Thompson Secondary in Invermere, BC. Similar programs exist across Canada. Food Share Toronto has organized school salad bars using local ingredients since 2002, though without direct involvement from farmers. Northern communities face the challenges of a short growing season and a paucity of independent farmers, which force some schools to buy up to 80% of their winter salad bar ingredients from the grocery store. This underscores the need to increase farming and food storage at the local level, Ms. Bays said. Turning kids into root vegetable fans is easier in elementary schools because the students can't drive off in their cars to McDonald's, she says. Nevertheless, the salad bars have thrived in high schools where students are involved in harvesting and food preparation and convince their peers to break the junk food habit, she adds. And that's your news from Disrespect this week. Come back next week. We will have more. And to take us out, Marcia Ball and Luella. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.